Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
And good morning. Welcome to Speak Up for Monday, June 24th. We are officially into summer now.
In December?
No, we're officially into summer.
Okay, I sound like December.
My name is Magnus Tewald. With me today here is
Peter R.H.
And we have a fine show for you today. We're hoping someone from the Peak will be by shortly to tell us about their issue, new issue they have out this week. And that'll become a regular segment over the summer and into the fall. Fill you in on what's happening here on campus.
Maybe to mention, it's all online. You don't see copies of the Peak over the summer because it's online.
Yes, of course. If you're not familiar with what the Peak is the SFU student newspaper, and they print a hard copy edition, a physical edition throughout the school year. And this summer, they're only digital, so you got to go visit their website, and we'll tell you a bit more about that later. We have some interesting stuff for you today. We have a report about the Sumas Prairie and the idea of returning it back to a lake. And we also have a little report also about Mission Council turning down flying a flag pride at Mission City Hall. And what are you here to talk about today, Peter?
I'm here to talk about, last summer we had all the Canadian forest fires. So I'm going to be talking a bit about that. I heard something accidentally on Ideas, I think on the CBC radio show. Mm-hmm. And one thing they were saying, and I wanted to check up on this, was, they say it's climate change. But another one is that a lot of the clear cutting has produced a lot of softwood trees, mm-hmm. in a sense that the type of tree we have and also the environment of the tree itself could lend more to the fire or the fires becoming stronger.
All right, very interesting. It's very topical at this time of year when we're heading into fire season. All right, you remember a couple of weeks ago, Peter, that we had that interview with the mayor of Abbotsford talking about plans for recovery from and building in resilience to the floods flooded the whole part of the Fraser Valley a few years back.
We got that from some other radio station too.
And this report we're going to hear from now is also from our friends at CIVL, the same reporter Mike McCullough, really interesting because, of course, it's an interesting environmental issue facing us. And it's sort of an interesting issue to talk about. So what this report's going to be about is a researcher at UBC has produced a report about the idea of transitioning that region back to a bit more to its more natural state, I'm sure they'll talk about this in the report. I don't want to go too deep into it. But, at one point, that whole area of the valley was a big lake through most of the year. And through a process of building canals and drainage ditches and stuff, they sort of drained the area to turn it into to farmland. And it is some of the most productive farmland in British Columbia because of such rich soils. It's been in the news a bunch lately about the challenges of protecting that area. from future floods. There are a lot of challenges in that. And of course, so one of the other thoughts around that is that maybe rather than trying to permanently protect it from floods and the impact that has on the infrastructure that's there, maybe we should think about working with nature and letting it flood a bit. So this is a report from Mike McCulloch at CIVL, which is in Abbotsford, responding to about that report and the response of the Abbotsford mayor.
Is getting out of the way of Mother Nature on Sumas Prairie cheaper and perhaps even justified? The authors of a University of British Columbia research paper probed this question, now nearly 3 years after the November 2021 flood and 100 years after the waters of Sumas Lake were drained to make way for the farms that dot the lake bed today. The paper's lead writer is Riley Finn. He's a staff researcher in UBC's Conservation Decisions Lab. Finn says the paper has three angles.
One of them was to really kind of situate the history of how Sumas Lake became Sumas Prairie. Then we wanted to get an understanding of, you know, what are the potential costs of returning the lake? And, you know, what does a potentially more inclusive process for determining the future look like? And so to get at those second two pieces, we looked at the assessed land values that come from BC assessments, and we overlaid historical mapping of the lake boundary on top of those.
Finn says to then determine a future with a restored Sumas Lake, the paper draws on the RELAW program,
which is revitalizing laws for land and water, which is a program run out of West Coast Environmental Law. And they worked a lot with First Nations and the Lower Fraser to kind of codify legal codes from oral histories and community dialogue.
My name is Murray Ned. Ancestral name is Klawsentin from Samath. And I guess a couple of capacities, Mike. I'm a former counselor for Sumas First Nation, but I remain as an advisor to the nation, specific to this file. And then also I work for the Lower Fraser Fisheries Alliance as their executive director.
And Ned's family tree is directly connected to the opposition to draining the lake in the first place.
My late great grandfather was the chief back then. His name was Selsmilton. That was his ancestral name. And he was the one that opposed the lake back, well, the draining of the lake back in the 1920s, but they proceeded anyway. So
Ned worked closely with Finn on this paper.
We don't want to do the same kind of displacement that the nation and our ancestors that lived there before when the lake was drained. We know what it's like to be displaced. We know what it's like to lose that piece of the ecosystem. And today it's invaluable.
The paper explores a path where the Sumas Prairie becomes something of a hybrid of what the area looks like today, mixed with what it might have looked like a century ago.
There are stories from back when the lake still existed of, you know, cattle being grazed and crops being raised around the lake. So this was something that was occurring before the lake was gone. And I don't think it's unreasonable to imagine a future where, you know, you could have some of both with a more resilient to potential flooding events.
The lake was renowned for having all five salmon species plus steelhead and, you know, wildlife, elk running around here.
And how does a revitalized lake bed make inroads toward reconciliation?
We would be interested in return of the lake if it didn't have such an impact on the local people. And so perhaps what we're after is maybe something in between that doesn't affect the people and the agricultural industry as much. And if there's, you know, willingness for people to think about a bit of a transformation from what we're doing today.
The study estimates a managed retreat buying up lake bed properties would cost about $1 billion, less than half of the $2.4 billion cited by the paper to bolster flood mitigation infrastructure.
So when we looked at kind of the overlay of the lake bed with the surrounding properties, we found that the assessments data attached to kind of the parcels in the region were about $1 billion in terms of the assessed values. And so, yeah, those might be different than what the market values are, but, you know, the data we have is the BC assessments data. So that's what we found looking at kind of a broad area in terms of the lake bed as well as the surrounding floodplain around it.
Politically, Abbotsford Mayor Ross Seaman says the concept is a non-starter.
Not on my watch.
Siemens thinks the report has, quote, so many inconsistencies, end quote.
Just based on reality, but I would invite people to come and take a look at what is happening on Sumas Prairie and get your head in the game. That is not a no-go on my estimation.
Siemens says protecting the farmland on the Sumas Prairie is critical.
Well, this is the most valuable farmland in the country, the most productive. The fact is, where do we find arable land like that anywhere else in the province? So our food security, number one, this is people's livelihoods. These are third, fourth generation farmers that are now responsible for, you know, 50 to 60% of our dairy and poultry in the entire province of British Columbia are coming out of Abbotsford, and a vast majority of that's coming out of that prairie. People have invested their livelihoods, are here, their homes. That is just absolutely ridiculous.
When it comes to food security, Ned draws a through line from today to the past.
It's an irony. To me, as a nation member, it's an irony. They determined it was feasible to drain the lake back then and get rid of the food security that they had in the form of the lake. And then today, you know, they're talking about hanging on to industry and all the economic and livelihood considerations that occur with that. So, you know, I guess what we're looking at is trying to figure out a balance between what we have today and what we had in the past.
Let's not forget that British Columbia has to import food too. It's a two-way street. We can't just rely on others to be supplying our food. That is absolutely, you know, in today's changing world, when people are trying to protect their own areas, I mean, for us to just cut loose on food security is, you know, that is just a ridiculous notion from my perspective.
Finn says the paper tries to imagine a future where a version of Sumas Lake could be an economic engine for the Fraser Valley.
Like tourism and recreation, and how the value of the lake might bring people to the region in terms of, you know, the economically important species that it might support, such as salmon and sturgeon. You know, what is the value of recreational fishing and food and ceremonial fisheries for the nations, as well as commercial fisheries that the lake might help produce. So there are lots of potential knock-on positive effects that, you know, we would have to essentially spend quite a bit of time trying to model out in order to get a proper idea of, you know, what are the costs and benefits.
We want it to be productive. We want the water to be healthy. We want the associated species, salmon and other wildlife, to be able to utilize it in a good way.
For now, Mayor Siemens is unambiguous.
Just to assure that my residents that I've got their back on this one, and I will go to the wall on that.
As for Finn, he's not fazed when confronted with opposition to the premise of a revitalized lake.
Our lab looks at decision science, and so, you know, really getting a broad view of the potential alternatives and considering, you know, what are the values that we're really trying to achieve. I think we just kind of saw that the broadest set of alternatives weren't really being considered, and there might be value in, you know, bringing a broader discussion.
For Civil Radio, I'm Mike McCullough. This story was made possible by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. For this story and more, visit frequencynews.ca.
And thanks to Mike McCullough for that report there. Very interesting idea, Peter. Of
Yes, okay, go on.
I'm not surprised a bit about the opposition of the mayor. I think, you know, I sort of wonder whatever he might privately think. I think, you know, nobody likes sudden dramatic change.
I know
somebody in their community, so I'm not surprised he's a little opposed. But you know, it's really important to, I think, look at all these alternatives, you know, so that you, when you do decide what the actual response needs to be, that you've at least considered them.
I know somebody who lives, he's almost in Chilliwack, but he's on the border of Abbotsford and Chilliwack, and I mentioned, he didn't hear the show, but anyway, 2 weeks ago, but He mentioned he didn't care for the mayor of Abbotsford, or is that Abbotsford mayor?
Yeah.
He said, "Oh, he was corrupt or something." I don't
know. Well, who knows about that? I've never heard any evidence to that effect, but I don't know that. You know, honestly, you know, we're down in Vancouver, so I don't know that much about the mayor of Abbotsford. You know, but you know, people have those opinions. You know, a lot of people have those opinions about politicians they don't like.
Yeah, I know. He has some strange. I just, have you ever heard? I don't know. He said it was mismanagement or something.
Whatever. Who knows? All right, here's another report about another community in the Valley. And this is an issue that's come up before. It is, of course, Pride Month here. And many communities are marking the month by taking special activities, whether it's festivals or, in many cases, showing their support for the LGBTQ plus community by flying the Pride flag. Here in the Student Union Building, they have the Pride flag prominently displayed, and many other places. Here's another report from Mike at CIVL. About the recent decision by Mission City Council to not fly the Pride flag.
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, MAD, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.
Mission City Councillor Ken Harar's latest attempt to hoist a pride flag at City Hall in support of Fraser Valley Pride, held annually in Heritage Park, has failed.
This is my third attempt, I believe, that I brought this motion forward. And I was actually really excited and hopeful that it would actually, pass, or at least that it would be brought on the table for a discussion. I wasn't sure so much that it would pass, but I thought there would be some support for it.
Harar first launched this motion 2 years ago in June. His latest failed motion, tabled at Monday night's council meeting, sought to amend the city's flag etiquette policy passed in March 2023 after it was moved by Mayor Paul Horn, per the City of Mission's meeting archive.
Only the national flag of Canada, the provincial flag of British Columbia, and the City of Mission flag are raised at city facilities.
With one exception.
During Veterans Week, the city's flag shall be replaced by the Royal Canadian Legion's poppy flag.
Following his motion's latest defeat, Councillor Harar says he felt snubbed by Mayor Horn.
When you snub me on this kind of motion, you snub the whole community there too, on the Pride community. And they'll tell you, oh, I support it. They're doing this. He should have took the time to listen to what I had to say. He snubbed me tonight. He snubbed me. He purposely did not want me speaking on it.
Harar admits he was hesitant to try this motion again.
I didn't want to do it. I tell you why. I brought this back because I had conversations with the Fraser Valley Youth Society people. And they asked me. They go, Mr. Harar, I said, what do you guys want me to do? Do you guys want me to bring it back? It took a couple of days to think about it. It was yes, the members would like you to bring it back.
So Harar, along with members of Fraser Valley Youth Society, then went to work on putting together a statement.
And I was going to read it out tonight for them. I'm sorry, I'm just really upset. You know, you work so hard, right? And you get bullied, right? So, anyways. Sorry about this. I didn't see this coming, but he does that to everybody.
Harar used our interview as an opportunity to read some of the quotations that he wished to read at council.
It goes, flying the pride flag means my community says without judgment that I deserve to be here and they want me to feel safe, end of quote. What may seem like a small act to some may mean the world to others. To me, flying a pride flag shows that people care and learn about my lived experience. Quote. And one other quote is, a pride flag should be flown in mission to show support to the queer community during the month of Pride. It is vital to show allyship to the queer community, to bring unity to the community as a whole. End of quote. These are young people that are expressing what they feel. And, you know, this is how our city leaders treat this? It's embarrassing.
We asked Mayor Horn for an interview. Through the city's communication manager, he opted to issue a statement. Quoted in full, with respect to Councillor Herrar's notice of motion regarding raising the pride flag at the City of Mission's City Hall, the motion was not seconded by another member of council and therefore could not be spoken to or debated. This is standard parliamentary procedure and no different from how items that are not seconded have been dealt with in the past. The fact the item was not seconded is consistent given a similar matter was fully debated and not supported on two separate occasions. The city remains very supportive of inclusivity and diversity. We have supported Pride by hosting and attending the Pride Festival at Heritage Park, providing support for liquor permitting, providing office space to Fraser Valley Youth Society, who host our Pride events, proclaiming Pride Week each year, and flying the Pride flag at our leisure center. End quote. This is how Mayor Horn put it in March 2023, when council passed the existing flag bylaws.
We will continue to support anything to do with diversity in our community, and I am very strongly in support of inclusiveness, including the LGBTQS population and any other group. But I don't think that changing our flag policy increases dialogue. Instead, it just increases controversy. I don't think it's up to cities to provide places for people to fly their flags. That just simply starts getting into an area that is dubious from my perspective.
As far as Councillor Herrar goes, he wants the mayor to hear his concerns and apologize.
He should have apologized to me and apologized to the LGBT community, because I had a motion on the table and I had words ready to say, and he never let me know. You know what? I'm asking for an apology. That's what I'm doing.
For Civil Radio, I'm Mike McCullough. This story was made possible by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. For this story and more, visit frequencynews.ca.
And thanks to CIVL for that report. Here is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. It's dawn in a western marsh in midsummer, and man, those birds are singing. The males of more than a dozen species are staking out their territories and attracting mates. Let's figure out at least a few of who's who. First, let's hear the marsh wren just by himself. Now with everybody else. Let's spotlight the common yellowthroat. Now with everybody else. How about a solo from the red-winged blackbird? And again, with everybody. Oh, here's a usually shy guy, the sora. Now, with the full orchestra. Ready for a review? The marsh wren. The common yellowthroat. Red-winged blackbird. Sora. And now, everybody! Hear the whole thing again at birdnote.org.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Peter is in the studio with me, and you're going to talk about the forest fires. Forest fires have been in the news quite a bit. Well, they are always in the news quite a bit this time of year. This past weekend and a bit before that, news organizations have been following the story of a wildfire in Labrador that's threatening the big Churchill Falls hydropower development and the community that serves it with...
I was doing other research. That's interesting. I didn't hear about that.
All right. Well, tell us what you have.
Well, one thing, 70% of the firefighters in Canada are volunteer. They're not paid for it.
Right.
So that's a rather large number. 65% of the United States are volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we have to change that as such because, I was going to end it with this. I'm going to bring up part of the reason I have an idea that Canada doesn't have an actual military anymore. No, wait a minute.
Okay. Changing topic there.
No, it's not.
Okay,
Go
ahead.
It's not. It's not a change of topic. Because I've said this idea. I don't think Canada should have a military. I mean, why even be part of NATO? I mean, if anybody invades us, you know. And they say, well, one thing the military does is it helps in emergencies and all of that. Well, then I came to that. Well, why not have emergency services then? You have emergency services. Now, maybe the United States would actually like us not being part of NATO if we have a more pronounced emergency service. We don't have a military, and we actually have something that could stop forest fires because we put our heads to the gear and stop them. So that's sort of an idea I had.
Well, one thing sort of related to that topic, and, you know, you're talking about how the majority of firefighters, in fact, volunteers, is I've also heard that traditionally or, you know, until the recent past, firefighting was, for the most part, a sort of seasonal job where, you know, there'd be a bit of training in the spring and then there'd be a fire season. And then you'd sort of wrap things up, and that was it until the next spring. Whereas nowadays, the fire season starts so early and goes later into the fall than it used to, combined with the fact that there are demands from other areas for firefighters, so that it's almost a year-round, it can be almost a year-round occupation now. Because, you know, you're here busy for longer throughout the year than they used to be. And then when they're not needed here, there's, you know, sent off to other places, whether it's Australia or wherever, that are having their fire seasons, and people are doing it all the time. You know, used to be very seasonal because the need was only seasonal.
Well, that's a shocking number. 70% are volunteer,
mm-hmm.
especially when it went into the New York City area last year and so on. One thing that was interesting. Supposedly, in 1789, New England was covered by Canadian forest fire smoke. Supposedly, mm-hmm. there was something major happened there.
I remember that was a big deal last summer because there was
1789.
Huge...
1789.
Oh. Well, it also happened last summer. You know, because there is huge fires in Ontario that created a great smoke pall that sort of flowed down from Ontario down to through like New York State and New England and stuff and covered all those regions in a thick orange haze because it was such a big set of fires and I guess the wind was blowing in that direction.
Well, the other thing is when you have what's called a monoculture, because when they when they cut down a forest and it's replanted and you have like one type of tree and you don't have the mosses and so on,
mm-hmm.
you can have five trees go on fire and that'll be like 5,000. It just will automatically do it.
Yeah.
I mean, not in an ordinary forest, but one that it becomes a monoculture.
Right.
And and we're getting more and more of that now because they're cutting it down. And
mm-hmm.
There was an advertisement, not on our station, but on other stations.
Yeah.
Forestry, I think it was done by other forestry companies, said only 2% of what we cut are the old growths.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, if it's so low, then why not just stop doing that? But there actually, some people were telling me they want to have the old growth because it's not the same type of wood. Like what you get from a replanted one is soft mm-hmm. wood. And they want to get more diversification. But it seems to me that in this case, this could be a cause of it because you're getting something that can more easily go on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me.
Yeah. Well-